The House Committee on Interim House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. Welcome, everyone. Glad to see you all here. Colleagues, we have 3 hours this morning, and we'll try generally to allocate an hour to the first agenda item, roughly 30 minutes to the second, and then 45 and 45, but in all likelihood, we'll go off track someplace. Excuse the pun. And so with that, we'll open the informational meeting and invite Ms. Lassine and Mr. Buffalino up.
Good morning, Chair Bentz, Chair Hunt, and members of the committee. My name is Susie Lassen, and I chair the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to provide a quick context for the information Mr. Buffalino and others will present to your committee today on freight issues. The Oregon Freight Advisory Committee is made up of representatives of all freight modes, air, marine, truck, and rail, but also local, region, and state government representatives, as well as industry. We discuss issues, have a cross-sharing of ideas, and advocate for improved transportation in Oregon. This committee was formalized through House Bill 3364 in 2001 and was given the mission of advising the department, the Oregon Transportation Commission, as well as the legislature on freight issues, project priorities, and funding needs that support a sound transport system that ensures the economic vitality of the state. We take this role seriously because Oregon's industries are uniquely dependent on a vibrant transport system. With 1 in 5 jobs reliant on trade, the ability of businesses to receive inputs from and ship finished products quickly and reliably to larger U.S. and international markets feeds into businesses' decision to locate or remain in Oregon. Oregon businesses export more than $19 billion in goods annually, and we have a larger export-supported employment base than all but 4 states in the U.S. So for every $1 million in export sales lost, that means Oregon loses 10 jobs. We're a small market relative to our neighbors to the north and south, and we have to move our goods a fair distance to compete. But our economy evolved as a trade-dependent economy. And our taxing structure, largely dependent on job growth, is also critical for that. We are 9th in the U.S. in dependence upon trade activities. That in itself means that the transportation system needs to be humming for the businesses to reach the right market on the right mode at the right price. We have a lot to be proud of, a deepened channel on the Columbia, a river system that reaches into the inland U.S., keeping costs and emissions down, supporting our role as number one wheat exporter in the country. We have 2 Class 1 railroads that compete for our ag businesses, helping to keep costs competitive and provide a foundation for higher speed rail. And we are the smallest region with 2 direct flights overseas to Europe and Asia. We also have a truck network that connects our businesses across the state to their jumping off place to the next mode in the system to ensure they reach their markets as efficiently as possible. But these achievements may be fleeting if we don't continue our focus on the right investments to keep our industries competitive. Due to revenue constraints, we must be smarter and more creative in our approach to our multimodal transportation needs. In the last decade, the legislature has played a critical role in ensuring our transportation system remains vital and have put people to work. With Connect Oregon, the OTIA program, and the Jobs and Transportation Act, we have been successful. We have been able to accomplish things here in Oregon that others have not, and we urge your continued focus on this important issue. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Buffalino that will share with you the Oregon Freight Plan and key findings.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susie. The Oregon Transportation Department, we provide the staff to the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee.
Can you state your name for the record?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bentz, Chair Hunt. My name is Michael Buffalino. I work for the Oregon Department of Transportation in our freight planning unit. And at ODOT, we provide the staff support to the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee. We also take a key role in supporting the preserving, enhancing, and improvements on the freight transportation system. And so as we take a look at the freight system, we notice that this is a particularly multimodal transportation network. It includes the highway moves, it includes the rail moves, it includes the aviation system, and it includes a port facility that make those connections to the rest of the world. The Oregon Transportation Commission has long realized that freight moves the Oregon economy. We noticed through our analysis that 1 in 5 jobs, once again, as Susie noted, is trade dependent, and that Oregon is the 9th most trade dependent state in the nation. The Oregon Transportation Commission has adopted policies through the Oregon Transportation Plan and the Oregon Freight Plan to help improve the freight transportation system. In 2011, the Oregon Transportation Commission adopted the first Oregon Freight Plan, which provides a roadmap for system users, owners, and operators to work together to manage operations and investment on freight infrastructure over the next 20 years. To develop this plan, the department worked together with a number of external stakeholders, including members of our Transportation Commission, the freight transportation industry, land use and environmental agencies, regional and local governments, our area commissions on transportation, metropolitan planning organizations, and the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee, all provided context and input to the development of the Oregon Freight Plan. The freight plan itself was led by a steering committee. I've included the list of names for our steering committee members in the attachment. And also, we convened specialized committees when technical topics came up to provide expert input into the development of the plan. The plan took a look at the existing multimodal infrastructure in the state of Oregon, industry logistic patterns as they exist today. We also included economic and freight demand forecasts that are driven by population, industrial production, and commodity flows. Some of the findings of the freight plan indicate that over the next 20 years, we'll see an overall increase in freight movements. We'll see a growth more in the value of the cargo we moved over the tonnage. In other words, we're going to be moving more high-value goods as we transition to more manufactured goods moving across the state. So we're looking at specialized equipment being produced. We're looking at food processing. We're looking at equipment manufacture, et cetera. One of the other findings of the freight plan, trucking will continue to be primary mode of choice for many freight moves. This will reflect in, of course, that shift to the higher value production. The greater time sensitivity of the logistics systems, and also the ability of the trucking mode to make that last mile connection between the terminals, to the ports directly, and then to the customer, or to a rail transfer facility. So it is the truck that provides that flexibility across the state. We also found that rail demand will increase due to growth in container and bulk commodity shipments through Oregon, and that this will create capacity constraints along basically the I-5 and I-84 corridors, or the parallel rail facilities that would carry these goods. We see a substantial increase in air freight, specifically that move to higher value, low weight goods such as computer chips and sports apparel. And we see that different parts of the state are interconnected. And as we produced the analysis for the freight plan, we found that each area of the state had a strong connection to the other parts of the state. So we developed a strategic backbone that we look at when we're implementing the freight plan. A map is included in my testimony, and we identified a coastal movements north and south, western corridor along basically the I-5, but that's intended to also include the parallel rail facilities. We look at the Columbia River corridor, which includes the river itself for barge movement, the parallel rail facilities, and I-84. We also found that US 97 north-south includes substantial value and weight movements, and so we'll look at that and the parallel rail facilities. Additionally, US 20, which primarily highway connection, moves a lot of freight across the state. The plan itself identifies 15 freight system management issues that we address through 35 strategies and 55 action items. And one example would be that capacity constraints, congestion, unreliability, and geometric deficiencies on key highway, rail, air, and marine freight corridors cause inefficiencies in statewide freight movement. And to address this, what the department is doing to carry out one of the freight plan strategies is we are working with the Freight Advisory Committee to identify freight bottlenecks. Currently, we are working on the highway bottlenecks. The department has a lot of data when it comes to highway management. We are also about to start marine and airport, coordinating with the marine and port managers to identify the needs there and the bottlenecks that need to be addressed in the short term and out through 20 years. And we will continue to work and expect to start the rail effort also. This will involve coordination with our Freight Advisory Committee. Once we've identified the key target areas, we would be communicating that directly to our area commissions and MPOs and working with them to identify the appropriate solutions, and that some of these solutions may include public-private partnerships, specifically where the infrastructure is owned in private hands. The department looks forward to working through all of the issues identified in the freight plan, everything from the identified system to the last mile connections to the improvements with coordination. So as we work on these issues, we'll be coordinating with our partners in the Freight Advisory Committee and throughout the state. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and we'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Questions? Yes, Representative Lindsay.
Kind of just some observations, Mr. Chair, and if you want to respond, that's fine. But Mr. Buffalino, I'm hoping I'm saying that correctly, said that that you're seeing a lot bigger containers on rail and a lot more freight. Air freight as well. My concern is, and then also you said you're going to be doing a lot of studies on bottlenecks.
Yes.
And I've got a lot of studies just by driving them myself. And I just say, please take a hard look and at 217 and 26. And, I just got back from, I guess it's been a couple months, I took a trip down to Utah, and they have a smaller metro area than Portland, and I believe I've driven most freeways in Portland Metro, and I think the widest lanes are three lanes, and sometimes you get a couple that are four, but that's the on ramp, off ramp, but that's the widest is three lanes. Most of them are two lanes, and compared to Utah, which is a lot smaller than Portland, smaller than Portland. They have five, six lanes. I mean, it's beautiful. And especially if we're getting bigger containers, if we're getting bigger air freight, we need trucks to get stuff to and back from those containers. So I hope that we take a little bit of a look on this. And in that, when I asked ODOT about 217 on helping 217, the answer was, okay, well, we've got wider shoulders. That's our solution to the situation is wider shoulders. Okay, I understand that, but I hope we can recognize this, that we do need more lanes. I understand all the other concerns, but if we're getting bigger containers, bigger freight, there's a critical mass that we need to be able to get stuff to and from that.
Chair Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Knowing that we have such significant resource limitations, increasingly federal resource limitations, declining gas tax revenues, et cetera, as you look at it, I mean, as you've kind of gone through and talked about each of the modes having needs, each of the modes having growth opportunities and expectations, how do you internally within the Freight Advisory Committee deal with that prioritization looking forward? I mean, are there some places where you may be advising us, you know, start shifting the percentage more to highways, or start shifting the percentage more to air freight, or more to rail? I mean, how do you do that balance? Because I mean, within the Connect Oregon process, there's a balancing act that happens, but the approach has largely been, because there's been so many needs over the last 10 years, just kind of spread it out, knowing there's going to be benefit everywhere. Right. Looking ahead at the next 10 years, what's your advice to us as to where we get the biggest ROI?
Well, I think Michael talked about the bottlenecks analysis that's in progress right now. I think that's going to help advise certainly the Freight Advisory Committee as well as the legislature on key problem areas. When I think about putting money into the transportation system, what's going to give you the biggest return really has to do with fixing those choke points, making those connections, and using ITS technology to inform both the user of the system as well as the industry themselves. You know, we're going to need to spend more time working directly with businesses, trying to understand what their logistics needs are in much more detail than we have in the past. That's going to be critical, I believe. Then you create the partnership with industry, and it really becomes something that we're all working toward resolving. But ultimately, I think having the bottlenecks report and then focusing our investments on connections to the various modes, dealing with those choke points and using ITS technology to help supplement those issues.
Representative Nixon.
Thank you. I am particularly interested in the problem of bottlenecks or choke points, and I was just looking once again real quickly through the printed report that we have, and I don't think that's discussed in here. I wonder if you could, if the remarks you made this morning in your testimony, if those are in writing, could you please send those to me? It at least mentions it.
Yes, we do have written materials on the development of our bottleneck identification process, and I could send that to you.
Thank you. A brief follow-up?
Please.
Sometimes it takes a long time to study something, and at the end of the day, you figure out, after all that study, you figure out all it did was demonstrate what you already knew intuitively. The problems are A, B, and C. Only by now you've spent 2.5 years and maybe $500,000 doing professional studies to tell you what you already knew. Is there a way we can start working on choke points sooner rather than later?
I'd be all for that. but I think what we do need is we need some foundation, because I think, as Representative Hunt mentioned, in the past, the needs have been so great that investments in the system overall have benefited businesses generally. We are getting to a point where we are going to need to make very strategic choices, and so having that information is going to be critical.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, one thing, we see that gas tax revenues aren't keeping pace with transportation needs, right? I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm glad that folks are working on a Pacific Coast infrastructure plan. It also, one of the drivers is that more and more baby boomers are retiring, driving less. That's a trend that's going to continue for a while. It also makes me concerned about senior safety, pedestrian safety. We know that traffic speed is the single biggest indicator of lack of traffic safety. I didn't notice it in a glance at the brief report I was given here. what about and how does the Oregon Freight Plan address senior and pedestrian safety, maybe even bicycle safety, along freight routes?
Chair Bentz, Representative Smith, we do include a freight plan issue item and a strategy to address safety, and that is we are to identify safety improvements and include them as we improve the freight transportation system. This is a focused topic plan, and so as we intend to use this in addition to our mode-specific and our Oregon transportation plan, and so this supplements and focuses primarily on freight. However, it does not ignore such items as the environment and safety. So we do have a specific item to coordinate with the established processes to ensure safety as we develop our transportation system.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
I didn't know what any of that meant.
Okay.
So I heard coordinating with existing processes for safety. That begs the question of what the existing processes are, and if we have people dying on the side of the road, I'm not sure they're sufficient. Where might we find, or what would be the best thumbnail you could offer us now to have greater confidence in how the Oregon Freight Plan is addressing safety?
Representative Smith, if I might, what I would like to convey to you is that safety is number one for all freight modes. That fundamentally is the basis for improvements to the system, is ensuring that the goods move efficiently but fundamentally safely. So what's in the Oregon Freight Plan largely reflects the need for improved safety on the system. And so there are specific policies that begin to address, you know, how we coordinate with other modes, how we ensure that our connections are safe connections, and how we ensure that ultimately the projects that come out of this process reflect safety and the needs of the community.
Chair Bentz, Representative Smith. Specifically, the freight plan calls on us to work with the ODOT Motor Carrier Transportation Division, Rail Division, and other programs within the state to advance freight issues for consideration in safety plans. So it is to specifically coordinate with those efforts.
Great. And just one follow-up. If we could think about also, yes, the two things you mentioned, and also if there are, I mean, you know, having an age-friendly system and being aware of sort of an aging population, if we could throw that in our plan, that would be valuable.
Just a couple of questions. It seems to me that we all would like to know how Oregon measures up against our neighbor to the north and to the south when it comes to freight mobility. So how do we do that? How do we compare our state's performance to Washington and to California? What are the elements of the yardstick to use?
Well, my perception is basically that the system provides an efficient movement for the businesses that are reliant on it. And it goes back to, are the businesses comfortable with planning for future growth of their own activities? Do they feel that they're able to reach the markets that they need to reach? Is the service there for them? Is the cost competitive? We are always challenged with having a system that's adequate to serve the freight needs, but is not overbuilt. And so I think it's keeping a close watch on how efficiently that system works for our businesses. I personally can't tell you the difference between the two states and Oregon, and I'm not sure that we have done any specific analysis related to that. So I would really use the businesses and their ability to grow, their challenges in terms of getting to markets, and the service quality as a measure.
I was actually thinking that might be a cost per freight mile number someplace that we could we could check. And I'm particularly interested in this because of the low carbon fuel standard discussions we're going to have. And I want to know how this plan addresses the impact such a standard might have upon freight mobility in Oregon. So there should be a measure that you already have that's been put together before we start this low carbon fuel standard discussion so that we can compare and contrast what that two futures might hold. So having said that, do we have those tools in place now so we can appropriate, you guys can appropriately advise us as we're considering some of the proposals I think we're going to see in the governor's 10-year plan?
Michael.
Chair Benz, the Oregon Freight Plan includes a chapter on the interplay between environmental needs and the freight transportation system, and would and develops a lot of the issues specifically about how we would measure or how we would discuss those trade-offs. And so what we would look at, and I would have to get back to you on the specifics, but we have developed a lot of the information underlying the that discussion. The elements of the Oregon Freight Plan, and as we developed it, many of the items we identified through the development of the plan were brought across into our Green Step modeling, which is how we were modeling greenhouse gases. So as we looked at freight items in our greenhouse gas analysis, using our model that was focused on greenhouse gases, we brought information directly out of the freight plan and into that. So we did coordinate that, but as far as a specific cost per freight mile, I don't have that off the top of my head.
Well, at the risk of being way too simple about it, I would like to see the comparative cost per freight mile for Washington, Oregon, and California, including the cost of fuel. That seems to be fairly straightforward, at least on the surface. Is that going to be available? Is such a thing available?
I definitely would need to check.
Okay, so to me, the question here isn't just the road. It's the thing I think you mentioned on the first page of your report where you used to talk about institutional and organizational barrier. Is that what you mean by institutional organizational barriers, the low carbon fuel standard? Would that fit the barrier definition?
It potentially could.
I mean, that's...
Yes, It depends upon if that is actually creating a barrier or not.
Well, I guess we define barrier. Let's define it as high price. Let's assume the price is higher. Would that be a barrier?
It would be one element of a barrier, correct.
Yeah. I want to be clear on this. Am I going to receive back from you those numbers per freight mile for Washington, Oregon, and Idaho?
Right now, I've put down my notes to identify cost per freight mile for Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and California. So we will communicate back to you.
Excellent. Yes. Chair
Kutcher. Digging a little deeper in what Chair Benz was just talking about, it seems like that whole analysis, and maybe not just the per freight mile cost, but those comparative metrics of... It could be everything from, you know, the international freight times from our port to foreign ports compared to the rest of the West Coast, the internal congestion issues, whether it's road, rail, other internal congestion issues. It seems like there's somebody, maybe not even governmental, somebody in the private sector, it seems like must be tracking those comparatives. But I would think those comparative metrics would be really beneficial to recruiting new businesses here, because I bet, especially on a lot of the congestion ones and the geographic ones, we stack up really well, especially compared to Idaho. But even I would think, based on some of the population and congestion and geographic challenge issues in especially in California, Washington, we might be more comparable. But it seems like that kind of data should be out there. Maybe it seems to me like the per mile freight cost is just one piece of that, but that picture in general would not only be beneficial, I think, for policymakers to look at, but also really tell a very competitive story as we're trying to recruit and grow business here versus those other places.
Right, and I would just say, Representative Hunt, that I agree with you. I think those comparisons, those measures would be very useful. I think in the private sector, they have been used for a long time. I think where we're evolving is really our appreciation for the freight transportation system and its role in the economy, and therefore collecting that data. It's kind of new, to be honest. I'll tell you, on transportation passenger modeling, we have more than 25 years of experience there. We have quite a bit less on the freight side, so getting a lot of that data is still new. A lot of it's proprietary. I think it's a very good objective, and I think it's something that that we should strive for.
Further questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All the information, I just want to make sure you're going to get that to all of us, correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I get it to your committee staff, I can distribute it to you.
Okay.
Yes. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much. And next to folks, Brock Nelson and Terry Finn.
Good morning. My name is Brock Nelson. I'm with Union Pacific Railroad. Appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. What I intend to talk about is give you a little bit of an overview of Union Pacific at the system level and then drill down and talk a little bit about what's going on here in Oregon. First of all, I'd just like to say that safety is our top priority, and the safety of our employees and our neighbors and the communities we operate through is first and foremost in our operations. And then I'd like to say that I don't know how many of you are aware, but this year is Union Pacific's 150th birthday. We are celebrating that system-wide in numerous venues, and we'll be in Eugene on July 12th and Portland on July 13th and 14th with our Heritage fleet of equipment. It'll be open to the public to come and look at, and if you're out and about, we'd love to see you there. Union Pacific, we operate in 23 states, pretty much every state west of the Mississippi. We have 45,000 employees, 32,000 miles of railroad. We interchange with the Eastern roads in Chicago, St. Louis, Memphis, and New Orleans. In the state of Oregon, we operate about 1,100 miles of track and have about 1,500 employees. Now, we pay taxes to the state through our corporate income tax, property taxes, and public utilities fees. In 2011, we also, through our Union Pacific Foundation, gave back in excess of $300,000 to the communities we operate through in the state. I'm sure all of you are very much aware of the capital-intensive nature of the railroad industry. I often say that it is the most, but I don't know that for sure, but it is one of the most capital-intensive industries in the world. This year will be a record for Union Pacific. We will be investing $3.6 billion back into our infrastructure, and that's, of course, with private dollars, not with public dollars. In the state of Oregon, since 2003, we've invested approximately $690 million in the state. A lot of these improvements have come in the I-5 corridor, raising tunnel clearances in the Cascades, which has helped us be more competitive with truck traffic between L.A. and Seattle. In the last few years, we've been investing a lot of money into the corridor between Eugene and Portland, which benefits the Amtrak passenger service. So we're getting some increased speeds out here, which is going to help the on-time performance and reliability of the passenger service. We're currently working on a couple of sizable projects up in the Portland area. We're looking to modernize our Brooklyn intermodal yard through just really modernizing new gates, additional tracks, some new equipment. And then we're also planning to construct a connection between what we call our Brooklyn subdivision, which is our line that runs north and south through the state, to what's called the Graham Line, which moves east. This will help relieve some congestion in our Albina yard and up moving towards the port, where currently trains kind of have to buck the flow and go through Albina. Now they'll be able to bypass that and go east along the Banfield in the Graham Line. We think extremely highly of the Connect Oregon program. We hold it up as a shining star to the other states that we operate in. It's truly a good public-private partnership that, with layers of review and transparency, it's really a good program. And we appreciate being the beneficiary of some of those public dollars, and hope the program continues into the future. Wanted to talk just briefly about coal. We are, obviously aware that there are ports within the state exploring opportunities to export coal. We have a long history of hauling coal. We've been hauling coal as long as we've been in existence. We've worked with our coal shippers throughout that history. We will continue to work with these shippers and these export facilities as they explore their options going forward. And whereas I'm not a lawyer, I would say that railroads have a obligation as a common carrier to move, commodities, that are presented to us for transportation. So we do have some legal responsibility to move that coal, but we will continue to be involved in this. It's so early, and it has had obviously a lot of interest in the last month or so. So it's definitely something that's caught our attention. It's something that we are working on very closely. I guess I'd kind of like to just close out with a little bit about, how green we are as an industry. We can move one ton of freight over 500 miles on a gallon of diesel fuel. We can help relieve congestion by taking trucks off the highway. Not that we're intending to take trucks out of business. They're a competitor of ours, a partner. We can't go that first mile. We need trucks, but we can help relieve congestion on the highways, which will relieve some of the impacts we're having to our infrastructure. And so with that, I will commit to do my best to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. And before we go to the questions, we'll go to our next witness. Mr. Finn.
Debbie, I'm sorry. How do I turn on this computer?
You just will it, Terry. It happens.
Thank you. Co-chairs Bentz and Hunt and members of the committee, I'm Terry Finn representing BNSF Railway, and we're the second Class 1 carrier in the state of Oregon, and we've also been here for well over 100 years. And as you can see from the map, which is our route structure in the state of Oregon, we're a major hauler of grain in the United States. We serve export facilities in Portland, and we're a leading carrier of intermodal or containerized cargo. We work closely with our partners, such as the Port of Portland. We have major hubs in Portland, Klamath Falls, and Bend. Our Oregon trunk line, that center line running through the center of the state, has been over 100 years also, and is the major carrier for agricultural goods and other break bulk commodities from central Oregon south into California and north, that joins our system as it goes through Washington State and onto markets in Chicago and other places to the east. So I serve on both the Rail Advisory Committee for the State of Oregon, on the Freight Advisory Committee. I'm a past president of the Oregon Rail Users League here in the state. And I've also was an appointee to the state's Rail Funding Task Force, which looked at various options, revenue options for funding both freight and passenger rail. And I'd like to say that we work with all our users closely, and that includes both the freight interests in the state of Washington as well as the passenger rail interests in the state of Washington. You can see that we own that stretch of track that comes in from the Columbia River into the city of Portland. That's a major gateway into the rail gateway into the state. And our other crossing is at Wishram on the Columbia River. Not a lot of people, you don't even know, not sure what Wishram is. It's an old rail depot, but you can see where it crosses the Columbia. Let me join Brock in saying that I'm also happy to say that we consider the Connect Oregon program in the state to be one of the leading programs in the United States. And certainly I recommend it to colleagues in our 28-state system at BNSF, and I get a lot of calls about it. And I can tell you that it's studied by other state transportation committees is a way to go. And what I really like about it, I think, is its straightforward, no-nonsense approach to rail service, its transparency, and the fact that it really tries to emphasize the public benefit in wherever a rail improvement might be located, whether it's a Class 1 railroad, a short line, or even a spur industrial line in some community. The broad cross-section of Class 1 railroad, short line, and passenger rail users who are represented on the Connect Oregon program really are able, because of their rail expertise, to get a full vetting of projects. And they are reviewers who really understand the needs and the requirements of rail service. So we've been long very, very, very happy with that. BNSF Foundation, I want to add, also contributes to many communities in the state of Oregon. I think our contributions are up around $150,000 level annually, and I think that we're pumping in about $35 million or $40 million into the state. One of the biggest improvements we've been making are rehabbing the Oregon trunk line, that line through the central part of the state. We've been replacing many of the areas with concrete ties, taking the old wood ties out and replacing with concrete, which are longer lasting, usually build up train speeds, make the system more efficient. And I think I'll stop there too and take any questions you might have.
Questions for this panel? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully both of you can answer this. What is the number one headache that you have to deal with government-wise, that you wish you didn't have to, might keep you up at night, or wish you could just have out of the way, that if you want to become more successful, that you wish you didn't have to deal with that, or could improve at least?
You first.
Oh, me first. Okay. First off, I'd like to just address the committee. I've met with many of you. I'm a 32-year operating person and a 5-year public affairs convert, so I apologize if my addressing of the committee and protocol is not appropriate or correct. I'm learning. So I think for me, for you at the state level, I think working with the states to have them understand what they can control or affect or not control and affect when it comes to railroad operations. You know, it's sometimes we get rules and regulations, you know, that are trying to control us at a local level when it's an interstate commerce issue. And it's just what I try to do is talk with folks to have them understand what they have the ability, you know, to affect and not affect, because you cannot, you know, ultimately impede our ability to move interstate commerce across our network. But I don't these days have anything I think that's keeping me up at night. The railroad, we talked about, or I mentioned, how capital intensive we are. You know, we have to be able to make money to be able to invest and grow and meet the demand. And regulations and rules that affect our ability to do that are not only at the state level or at the national level are a big concern for us.
And Mr. Chair, just following up on that, do you have some specific things, or can you, these regulations?
Well, just, you know, of late there's been, and more federal than, of course, state, just increased regulations over where a railroad can invest or how much it can charge, those types of things that would, again, impede our ability to make money and invest. You know, we invest where it makes sense from a business perspective. So anything that limits our ability to do that is a big concern for us. But there's nothing really pressing right now along those lines.
I would say if there are bottlenecks, one thing, let me back up and say one thing, the railroads aren't very used to going to government throughout their history. We're mostly, you know, by and large, far and large, we're privately financed, so that's the way we make our investments, are from private sources. But I think the thing that most endangers rail service are probably well-intentioned attempts at various kinds of regulation, but regulations for which the purveyors do not think out the consequences. So, as an example, there was a recent attempt, well, it's not too recent now, I think it was at least 2 years ago, in the Oregon legislature, they talked about slapping an additional fuel tax on rail. And as many of you know, the Class 1s enjoy some federal exemptions that local railroads, that in-state railroads, may not have. But as we see this happening and try to deal with a state-by-state basis with different forms of taxation, and I see this in Washington State also, so they're not unique, but I think that then it becomes a real potential problem for operations, for consistent rail operations across state lines. And I think that that's something, if I had a magic wand, that I would ask all legislatures to look at and try to, as much as possible, while railroads don't enjoy paying taxes, we actually pay quite a bit, but we'd like them to be uniform as much as possible.
Questions? I have a couple. On your chart here, which I really do like, there should be, I wish you could add some reflection of the return of dividends that your company pays to those in Oregon, because that capital investment piece and how much money your organization actually makes for our residents would be of great interest. Whether you can do that or not, I don't know. But that's a missing part of the value your organization brings to the state. There's another thing, and I asked it earlier of the previous panel, and that is how we in Oregon compare cost-wise per freight mile to our two competitive states.
Yeah.
And I'd just be interested in knowing, is it about the same? Is there any difference?
You know, I don't know how to answer that exactly, and I don't know if we keep those kind of figures. I would think that it'd be the cost per mile of moving goods through one state versus another would be terrifically dependent on terrain, on weather, on obviously mileage, and also the volume of traffic. The unit cost for, say, moving a ton of wheat into the state of Oregon, it goes down the more and more volume you have. The per mile cost probably goes down. So part of it is a function of simple rail volumes. But we may have that. I'm not saying we don't. I just am not aware of that.
And I heard you ask that question to the first two, and I kind of made a mental note. And Terry put it much more eloquently than I could have. I've never heard of us look at it that way. But that's something I can certainly follow up on and see if we do track things cost per mile, like per state.
Representative Benz, I would add that. And it goes back to the bottleneck question, too. A major difference that I think we in railroading find from, say, the government approach to investment is, and this would include, I think, what ports do, too, they often are looking 10 years out or maybe even farther and trying to figure out what facilities do we need for the future. The rail approach is to basically look at what business are we seeing right now. There's a certain amount of leeway or flexibility in the rail system. So if we suddenly get a customer that needs 5 additional trains someplace, you know, our system can adjust to that. We can reroute things. We can pack things differently. But we tend to invest when the business is up to our ears. That's the way we invest. And sometimes that is a bit incongruous in the thinking between some government approaches and I think the railroad business approach. And both are viable. You need to think about both ways of doing things. But sometimes, say, the port would like to see that capacity laying there down the line before the rail company, for instance, would actually invest in it. So that's just something to think about. And I think it's something that many people in the public sphere don't quite understand the way the rail makes its investments. Plus, it's looking at a broad system and saying, where do I get the fastest return for X million dollars up into the system?
Well, the railroads were built with massive public investment, using land to get the railroads built. And your reference to our new modest investment in rails is interesting because it's so much smaller than what was done 100 years ago when those things were built. The question I would ask now is if we wanted to dramatically expand Oregon's rail system to the benefit of the state of Oregon, where would we do that? And I'm you'll forgive me if I assume it's at the port, but maybe I'm wrong. Is if we wanted to make your system better, where is that money best spent, or is it perfect the way it is?
Well, I tell you, for us going forward, you know, as we look at, we're typically looking out about 5 years. You know, maybe that's not as much as a lot of industries, but that's kind of what our plan for the future is. And as we look at capacity, one of the big themes these days is lengthening sidings. Back in the day when the railroads were first built, trains were probably never thought to be 5,000 feet long, whereas now they're 7,500 feet. Maybe at some point they'll be 10,000 feet. So sidings on a single-track railroad, which is basically what we have on UP here in Oregon, can kind of constrain your operation. So we're extending a lot of sidings, which will help fluidity and passing and meeting trains. I think for us, as we look at capacity projects, our greatest challenge, and it's going to be probably from a regulatory perspective, will be in the Columbia Gorge, just because of the proximity to the river, just the physical layout of our railroad, and the fact that it's a single track railroad. And if you have to try and add another track, you're now being faced with filling. And if you're filling along a river, you know, it's just going to be heavily laden with regulatory review and permitting. And I don't even know that some of those things can be overcome. So the gorge, Columbia River Gorge for us, is going to be just a challenge just physically and from a regulatory perspective, I think, going forward. The I-5 corridor, the north and south, were, you know, better off in regard that, you know, we pretty much have a nice size right away where, you know, if the business warranted it, you could probably build a second track. But again, a lot of capacity issues around sidings. Then there's the new positive train control, which is a federally mandated program that we're implementing. That's yet to be seen as to what that might do for capacity. It's a GPS-based system that'll kind of improve on our ability to dispatch trains and get maintenance windows and things of that nature. But and we already are, you know, focusing on our own bottlenecks. You know, we're talking about them here with OFAC and with ODOT. But, you know, this East Portland Junction project that we're constructing is relieving a bottleneck. You know, so we're chipping away at them with our own money, you know, as the business dictates it. But regulations and permitting, you know, we're not totally exempt from those requirements, and they're going to be a challenge for us just like they are everybody else.
And if I can just amplify a little bit, I keep thinking of more bottleneck answers as I hear the testimony, but I think that the siting issue is very interesting, and the railroad has been here a long time, and what we really find from the railroad perspective in trying to operate is that land use rules in cities and counties and everything else over 50 or 100 years have basically engulfed the railroad and entangled it with many, many, many more crossings, obviously, than what we started with lots of people living up near, close to active rail lines now. If we send out 500 letters a year in comments on development projects around the Western United States. It's fairly safe to say that most of them are probably ignored by the governments who are helping to sponsor new developments. And that's because, you know, part of it's tax revenue for local governments, but these also create additional problems for railroads, for complaints, and every year it gets more and more expensive to operate a rail line. Obviously, through a metro area is very difficult, but really across our system, we see this all over the place. Another addition, and I'll go back to sidings a little bit, because I think those sidings or passing tracks are very important. They're very important to the fluidity of the system, to how fast freight moves, and when you get to passenger rail, they're extremely important, because then you have trains moving at such widely differentiated speeds. And I'm used to hearing our vice president of passenger services in the companies that talk about that. For a dispatcher that's watching trains on a computer screen in Fort Worth, Texas, and a passenger train is moving up the tracks in the same direction, instead of being able to feed trains linearly, in a linear way, one after another, a freight train, the way you can often move them. And, of course, you have your meeting and passing trains, too. But a passenger train really requires about a vision of 60 miles up the track about how you're going to handle traffic because it's moving at a higher speed. So either the freight has to move over or somehow the passenger train has to run around. Otherwise, your passenger service is only as fast as your slowest moving freight. And it takes a lot of infrastructure and a lot of planning and a lot of manipulation, frankly, to make all that work. The passenger service alone puts additional pressure on the railroad for additional long sidings for freight trains and everything else.
Ms. Nathanson.
Thank you. You both heard me talk to you individually about sidings. And, you know, I'm sort of anxious about the situation because we do have trains that are built longer than the sidings, apparently. Which is why it's on your list of things, concerns. So I want to ask you both about something else that I don't recall hearing testimony in a setting like this with you specifically. I've asked others about separated grade crossings and slow speed over bridges or short sections of track where there's something about the way the land is configured and the track for a piece of a route or where there's a bridge and the speed has to be greatly reduced. It may not be terribly important to you to upgrade it in such a way so that it can take a higher speed because maybe it's really adequate for your needs. But what if looking longer to the future, longer than 5 years, as policymakers, when we're looking at expanding the regional economy, increasing the amount of freight volume, and improving passenger rail opportunities, maybe from our perspective, we would want to look at a longer time period and say we do need some separated grade crossings, and we do need to improve this particular section, whether it's a bridge or something else, and make it more than 6 miles an hour, for example, or 12 miles an hour. How does that fit into the way you would be discussing projects with Oregon or with Oregon and Washington combined, coming up with priority lists, where we see something as going to be eventually essential, but it's not within your shorter planning horizon.
I'll take a crack at that because, and as you know, Representative Nathanson, BNSF, has a pretty broad experience with passenger rail in several states, including this state and certainly the state of Washington. You ask a very good question, and if I can use the state of Washington as an example, most of you know that the recent stimulus money that came down, the ARRA funds, the state of Washington, I think, was in a position to collect about $750 million worth of passenger rail money for higher speed, not true high speed, higher speed passenger rail. And I think more than $500 million of that probably goes into the BNSF system, maybe $600 million. But that, what we do, we have a list of projects that need to be accomplished. And I'll say this, there are two different ways to do these contracts, and they've been done both ways. We're contractually obligated, what we're really contractually obligated to do is get passenger trains up to an average speed, and chop minutes off the schedule. Now, you can have a contract that really details just how you accomplish that in a series of various task orders for different projects, which is terribly bureaucratic. Or you can have one that says BNSF Railroad guarantees that you'll chop 10 minutes off the schedule and you'll achieve an average passenger speed of 89 miles an hour or 79 miles an hour. It's right now it's at 79, I think. So, but whatever that increase is, and the state agrees to that, and then it tells the railroad, you go figure out how to do that, which is probably what we mostly prefer because it allows us more flexibility. But we are able to identify the projects, and really what you're doing on that slow bridge or stretch of track that is moving 10 miles an hour, that's perfectly adequate for our freight needs. Mm-hmm. You're really bringing that up to a level where passenger rail can move across more quickly.
Yeah.
Now, does freight get any benefit from that? It does. But remember, you're also trading off periods of time on the freight rail tracks when you're running passenger rails. So it's sort of a trade-off. Maybe it's 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, something like that, where you have commuter operations too. But then we can't move much freight. So that's the kind of trade-off you're meant. And that's the subject of intensive negotiations, believe me, in all these contracts. Does that answer your question?
That helps, yes. Thank you.
Further questions for this panel? Yes, Representative White.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to kind of go off topic a little bit and back to something you were talking about earlier. Do we have a decent rail line from, like, Wyoming, North Dakota, where a lot of the coal mining is going on, if we were to put in a plant here where we were shipping coal?
We've got a great rail line.
Yeah. we both have great rail lines.
So that would be pretty direct to that. And may I follow up?
Please, sir.
I got a little process I'm going down because, I mean, there's different views in Oregon, as you know. There's probably some members up here who see coal as kind of like black tar heroin. I see it as cheap fuel for power generation for the state of Oregon and for other countries, and an opportunity for us to get out of some of our budget crisis. If we had that port opened up here, would it drive down the price of coal for us here in Oregon, you think, if we had coal-fired plants, if we utilize that?
I'll just say I'm not competent to say. I mean, I'm not a coal expert. I'm certainly not an energy resource marketing expert either. One of the arguments is that it would drive down the price, and you know, some of those opposed to coal exporting, for instance, saying that it would cheapen the world price and therefore expand the use of coal, we don't subscribe to that view. But as far as the price of coal domestically, I don't know. I mean, one of the attractions of Powder River Basin coal, for instance, which comes from Wyoming and Montana, and is about a 200-year supply of coal for at least the way this nation uses it, and might actually, the United States has the world's largest coal resources. That coal is mined so relatively cheaply and so easily and so safely compared to other countries that that's one of the reasons it's in such high demand. And as you all probably know, it's much lower in sulfur, it's lower in mercury content. I'm not trying to argue that coal is that's clean coal. I don't think there's any such thing. And we might all agree that we'd love to move away from that resource. But worldwide, in the last decade, the fastest growing energy resource by far is coal. It's interesting.
Representative Smith.
Yeah, thanks. On the same topic, and largely I think we're talking about maybe some domestic use, but I think it's primarily shipping to China, what are the decision points that impact your world that state and local governments have to be aware of when it comes to the fun soon to come negotiations around potential coal transport, understanding that those decision points are constrained by interstate commerce, but don't reach zero, right? There's still some decision points. Talk about some of the places we need to engage.
Well, going back to something Terry had said about how railroads, you know, invest and why we were probably, we being UP, were kind of unprepared of late when this issue achieved apogee. You know, there's got to be someone that's got some money to invest in a facility that's going to export or consume coal, and it's going to have to get permitted and follow established processes and procedures. And whereas we're aware it's going on, until that gets to a point where, you know, the ink is dry on the contract, no one's buying ties or rail for it. So for us, you know, the decision point's going to be when someone is close to getting or has a facility that's going to need coal transported by rail, that's really when we start to get engaged about it. And we talked about the capacity and again a little while, you know, the issue about do we have good rail lines from Wyoming to this neck of the woods. We do, but the just the sheer volume of trains that are being talked about publicly right now, whereas I think either one of our railroads would love to have the ability to move that many trains, I know mine doesn't have the capacity for it, and it's going to take a huge investment, no matter what the commodity is, to accommodate that, and probably years to be able to build out to that point. So we're just, you know, again, we're trying to get our arms around what this all really means, and I can't speak to, is it one train a day, two trains a day, or however many trains a day, and I can't speak to where it's going to go because I don't know who's going to have the facility yet. So it's an emerging issue for us, but the decision point, I think it's, you know, it's going to have to be when someone actually gets a facility permitted and ready to go.
The opponents of coal export in both Washington and Oregon, you know, and you're probably familiar with Governor Kitzhaber's recent letter calling for programmatic, I think he used the word programmatic analysis of coal export. And really what's that mean? There are actually six proposals for coal export sites. I think there are two in Washington and maybe four in Oregon. And what they've done, opponents have packaged all those together and said if all six sites were somehow permitted and they were all active, the opponents are going around to communities and saying this would cause 100 trains a day, 100 additional trains a day hauling coal through the into the Northwest, through the states of Washington and presumably Oregon. Now, we don't think that all those will ever be permitted. And as Brock has just said, our system capacity couldn't achieve that. I mean, it would be something much, much less than that. Having said all that, we've been hauling coal in the modern era. Forget what we did 70, 80, 90 years ago with coal in Washington. We've been hauling coal through Washington State for the last 30 years to the TransAlta plant, the one coal-burning plant in Washington. And we've also been shipping coal since 1995 into British Columbia for export. And I can tell you, until these recent announcements of coal ports in Washington and Oregon, virtually nobody ever paid any attention to it. We have two or three trains a day going through the city of Seattle. I venture to say there aren't 50 people in the city that ever realized coal was ever going through it. But now opponents are talking about clouds of coal dust all over the place. We think it's a manufactured issue.
Follow up first.
Any examples, and again, trying to get to, I mean, you'll have all sorts of business decisions to make, and obviously that'll wait until somebody gets a plant sited, and, you know, I won't ask you to opine on that too in advance. But trying to understand from a transportation perspective what levers the state municipal governments have and explicitly do not have to impact your world, impact the shipping itself. I hear what you're saying, that you think the concerns are overblown. Setting aside for a moment the whether or not, you know, concerns about enhanced cancer are real or not real, whether it's a poison or not a poison, setting aside some of that stuff for a moment, what are, from a legal and regulatory standpoint, the places where state municipal governments can and cannot engage? And one place, if that question is befuddling, is, are there other substances that are shipped where state and municipal governments do engage to either time, place, and manner, or yay or nay?
I'll take a crack at this since I kind of look at it every day. I think that the main pressure points, or the main leverage points that you're talking about decisions, would be on the permits needed for the proposed coal export facilities themselves. There is less regulatory jurisdiction over the railroads itself. For instance, we're already hauling coal through the state of Washington. We can add trains to British Columbia basically any time that market demands and wants to increase, and we can just run them. It doesn't require any kind of state or federal permitting, at least that I'm aware of. So the real decision-making points are on the actual permits, whether it's a water quality permit, air quality permits, wetlands, whatever else would be studied in the EIS for a coal or bulk export facility. Now, some of the issues which you already heard me talk about are, if that is too broad a scope, if the analysis is so broad, it begins to affect everything. It begins to affect intermodal facility at the Port of Portland or a new grain elevator someplace. If you want to analyze all the downstream impacts or some of the air quality impacts from diesel emissions, by the way, train diesel emissions have about the lowest footprint of any overland. But I think that's what you're getting at. It would be the local state permitting process. Okay. The State Environmental Policy Act and the National Environmental Policy Act for a given project.
I just like to echo what Terry said. This suggestion of a programmatic life cycle, I call it life cycle review or analysis of coal, if that were to occur, where would it stop? I mean, it would be everything, you know, theoretically, you know, timber, intermodal cars, computer, it doesn't exist today. You know, it's not a regulatory requirement that exists today. I totally agree with Terry that the issues are going to be at the facility. And again, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, we do have some legal responsibility to transport this, you know, if we've got the capacity and the shipper's willing to pay to move it for a fair price, we want to move it.
Yeah, I get that. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, we need to kind of move it along, though.
Sure. And I'm not asking about life cycle. I'm not asking us to analyze, you know, whether or not commerce is good or bad for human health, right? It's obviously both, and I hope to maintain commerce because I like to watch TV sometime from time to time. But I do still wonder, and I also understand that both legally and certainly from your business standpoint, you know, the siting of the facility itself is the place where most of the energy will circulate. I still wonder if there are any decision points around the transmission itself, around the transportation itself. Is there any, for example, is there any substance at all that is shipped or not shipped, that the transport itself is regulated in a different way by state and local governments than, you know, shipping my TV.
I'm not aware of any of those points. Now that, you know, the Surface Transportation Board and the federal government do have plenty of regulations about hazardous cargo, about what we call toxic inhalant cargo, which is things like chlorine. I mean, there are far more dangerous things than coal moved around for manufacturing, for city water supplies, all sorts of things. And as a common carrier, we are obligated to haul all of that stuff, even when we can't get buy enough insurance to insure ourselves from it. But I am not aware of any state. We certainly cooperate with state and local authorities. For instance, if we have a special cargo coming around, then we usually join in with local police and fire departments and trade information. And most of that is by TSA rule is kept fairly under wraps anyway. But I'm not aware of any state regulation or point which says, no, you can't bring that in here.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Very interesting presentation. With that, we're going to shift gears and move on to the Road User Fee Task Force. Mr. Whitney.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Whitty. I'm manager of ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. I appreciate the opportunity to come here today and update you on some real definite developments from the work of the Road User Fee Task Force and ODOT on the topic of potential policy change in Oregon to distance-based charge for light vehicles. As we discuss this, discuss a distance-based charge for light vehicles, it's important to know, understand how long we've had user pays policy in the state of Oregon. It potentially began in 1919 when Oregon passed the nation's first gas tax 93 years ago. It was certainly affirmed 6 years later, 1925, when Oregon legislature passed the ton-mile tax for heavy vehicles. And then by 1935, it was fully ingrained in our system when the state conducted its first cost responsibility policy. So that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 93 to 77 years ago, we've had user pays as the state's policy for setting taxes and revenue mechanisms to fund the state's roadways. The nature of our vehicles is changing right before our eyes. And it's been happening now since 1999 when the first hybrid electrics came in that were highly fuel efficient. Now we see electrics and plug-in hybrid electrics. I just passed the Volt on the way down. Heavy Volt. And there's become a big change in what happens with fuel economy and as well as revenues for our road system. Right now, today, the operator of a 2012 8-cylinder Ford F-150 driving 10,000 miles annually pays $214 in state gas tax. The operator of a Nissan Leaf driving the same amount pays nothing, state gas tax. Now entering 2011, last year, last July, we had official government, national government policy to move all vehicles to fuel efficiency. And this chart represents that. This chart is represents a million miles traveled in Oregon. And we have the CAFE standard, the corporate average fuel economy standard now for light vehicles that the administration set in agreement with the automakers of 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. So the automakers will be working hard to achieve that. So fuel economy goes up. That's a very good thing for numerous policy reasons, like reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and reducing reliance on foreign oil. But the gallons consumed as well, understandably, go down, and revenues also drop dramatically. In 2001, the Oregon legislature, and a bill started in this committee, created the Road User Fee Task Force in anticipation of this event. And it created the task force to develop a new system to replace the old, which is essentially the fuel tax on gasoline. It also directed ODOT to run a pilot program on the recommendations of the task force. The task force recommended a charge on distance traveled to replace the fuel tax over time. Then last session in 2011, the legislature passed House Bill 2138, which affirmed the Road User Fee Task Force process by adding additional factors to consider when the task force recommended doing a pilot program. So I'll give you a little more history. I think all of you are probably aware of this, but in 2006 and 2007, ODOT developed a pay-at-the-pump model for testing distance charge. And we installed GPS receivers and 300 volunteers for a year, and they paid 1.2 cents per mile. It received a lot of note nationally, actually got the nation excited about the whole prospect of potentially charging by distance. And we had the two national commissions, the Policy and Revenue Study Commission and the Infrastructure Financing Commission, that embraced the idea of a distance charge for replacing the gas tax. We also had the ASHTO organization and then the Miller Commission, which had several former secretaries of transportation on it that embraced the mileage charge as the future. The difficulty of doing so, however, was made known. They noted scalability of the system to 300 million motorists nationwide was rather challenging, to say the least. The idea of having that many accounts nationwide was bothersome. Also, the cost of the pay-at-the-pump model, putting technologies in various fueling stations across the country, was daunting. They also complained that the technology that ODOT selected would be stuck in time. One box in the car, it stayed there with no potential for evolution. Technologies evolve, as we know. And so that was one complaint. And the public weighed in as well. Privacy was a major concern. Although we were quite careful to not have any signalization or transmission of what was happening inside that unit, the public said, how do we know what you do with that government box? And you know they were correct. There was no way to tell. It was just a box. Compliance, they complained, they were worried about the expense and potential difficulty of it, and then they feared a large new government bureaucracy. So, what did ODOT do? Is it sat back and thought about some of these concepts and difficulties that the motorists raised and the national organizations raised, and altered it to reflect a new concept that adjusted to political and economic reality. So these are the new tenets. We asked the reconstituted Road User Fee Task Force in 2010 and 2011 to consider these, and they did, and adopted them. So the first one, there'll be no technology mandate or push to a particular technology. So this means no government box. There won't be one. Secondly, integrate with the existing technology market. People are using smartphones and navigation units and what are known as in-vehicle telematics right now, and they accept them. Integrate with what they've already accepted, not impose something new on them. provide them choices so they have various ways of complying with the law and reporting their mileage and paying for it. So they're not just one way, not a way they don't want, but maybe they can find one that they can accept. Make sure the system is open so that as technologies evolve, those technologies will be available for their use. They won't get stuck. And finally, private sector administration. These days, we can't see a lot of opportunity for growing a large new government bureaucracy inside an agency. So how do you deal with the need for this? You allow the private sector to come in to do the data collection, to do the tax processing, and to do the account management. And the government role shrinks to auditing and enforcement. So the task force also considered the methods by which the motorists would report their miles and came up with several. And during the last session, or 2011, this committee heard some of those. There's been some evolution in some of that. The idea of reporting directly from the odometer, like the insurance companies do right now, is viable. There's no GPS technology in those devices. That could be one option. Another, of course, is the use of a GPS device that the motorist already owns for another purpose. Although the Road User Fee Task Force has not embraced this yet, ODOT thinks that an alternative mechanism that does not involve electronics is important, that there be another method to report miles. And we're anticipating proposing what New Zealand has, which is the ability to buy miles in advance and with a true up at the end of the year. And then finally, another alternative that also is non-electronic is the flat, what we call the flat annual tax, to purchase unlimited miles per year. It would be purchase about an ability to drive without restriction. You simply buy the total amount that's possible to drive. And then finally, also I already mentioned this, never mind. Questions arose in the 2011 session that were very important to answer. How burdensome will the new system be on motorists? What will be the electronic means of reporting and cost for it? How costly will it be for ODOT to administer the mileage charge? And how many motorists will buy electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid electrics anyway? The last question, ODOT is undertaking a fleet forecast. And I expect to have that information in June. I've seen some early draft results where the people putting it together forecast 9 scenarios. Like, for example, the electrics will take over, or the plug-in hybrids will take over, or the hybrids will take over, or some alternative fuel will take over. Just various scenarios. And I must tell you that the trend for all of them, for the revenues from the system, has them all trending or spiking downward. No matter what the scenario, fuel efficiency is going to improve. We will also determine what system costs, so they can give an answer to how much a system will cost to run, as well as compliance costs for the motorists, so we can know what that is, and then an urban and rural analysis to understand the relative impact on rural and urban drivers will also be underway soon. We also will undertake a pilot project from September to December 2012. We have an RFP underway for... I just missed a big one. I'm sorry. Let me go back here. The big question that the Road User Fee Task Force asked me in 2011 is, will the marketplace want to play with this wonderful idea? That was a big question. I think it came up in here, too. We did an RFI in February and sent it out to the world. And then we planned for a workshop with one-on-one sessions. 19 firms signed up for 2.5 days, every hour on the hour. And then after that, they submitted responses to the RFI. 28 firms responded, from South Africa to South Korea, from New Zealand to Austria, and the United States and Canada, of course. I think we answered that question. They're very interested in participating. For the pilot, we have an RFP underway. We got 10 proposals from those 18 firms, and we're currently negotiating contracts with them to participate in the pilot and provide the technologies and accounting and all that. I can't reveal who they are because we're negotiating contracts at the very moment. The particulars are that it will start, it'll be a 3-month test in September. We're asking for 50 volunteers to actually pay the charge of 1.56 cents per mile and get a gas tax refund or offset. The participants, I'm hoping, are what I call VIPs, stakeholders, members of the Road User Fee Task Force, Oregon Transportation Commissioners, and I'm hoping for state legislators from the House and Senate Transportation Committees and House and Senate Revenue Committees. We will test any vehicle, well, not any vehicle, it has to be 2004 model or later. So it will be not just electric vehicles in this case. It's hard to come by volunteers for electric vehicles. There's not a lot of them out there yet, although I do know of one participant who will have an electric vehicle. The volunteers will sign a contract that allows us to reimburse the gas tax and impose the charge, and they'll receive instruction on how to do this in August. So how difficult will it be for the participants, including potentially some or all of you, to be involved? Let's talk about the three options for the onboard units. Now, we're going to be doing the technology portion in the pilot. The non-electronic portions are a flat angle tax is very simple. There's no reason to test that. And we don't have the other one yet approved by the task force. We're just doing the technology here. First one will be a basic unit. It will have no GPS in it whatsoever. And this unit is similar to the Progressive Insurance device, which is currently in use, and you see here on television all the time in the advertisements. This is called the Snapshot device. The device we will use is very similar to this. And it essentially, the reason it's called Snapshot, it snaps right into the diagnostic port of the vehicle. And then the motorist simply drives. And it will report the miles driven from that device. And then you get an invoice, either in the mail or online. Very simple. The second option, is to use essentially a version of the Snapshot device with a smartphone. In this case, it would have to be an Android phone because we do not yet have an app for the iPhone, but an Android app does exist. What it does is it'll connect to the Snapshot style device via wireless transmission called Bluetooth, so that if somebody wants to drive, say, out of state on a trip to the Tetons or down to the Grand Canyon, they say, I'm going to drive a lot of miles, I don't want to pay on those. Put an app on your Android phone, drive out of state, and the miles will now be collected in a non-tax bucket. So that's one option. You don't have to do it. You don't have to use it very often, only when you're going to take trips out of state. Again, a choice of the motorist here. And then the third one is a GPS unit. If somebody wants to use that, they may. We have two units, it looks like, if the contract negotiations go well. One will be able to, what's called geofence, off-road miles. So for those people who drive, say, off-road for agricultural purposes or touring for forestry purposes, ranching, those kinds of things, they could use this kind of a unit. And then a second one performs what I call internet-based or internet cloud-based functions, similar to what a smartphone does or other in-vehicle devices like OnStar and Ford Sync. So it's connected to the internet. The important thing here is it's designed for other purposes. It's not designed for this, for collecting mileage charges, but it could be used for that. And that really captures the vision of where we're going. You have a progressive insurance device. You can use it to report your miles. You have a GPS device for another purpose, navigation or whatever. You can use it to report your miles. It's not a government box. The technologies are already in use for other purposes and deployed here. There will also be two tax processors. One will take the ODOT roll for basic payment services, and then the second will be a private sector firm providing more sophisticated payment services. So that's it. I think it's a fairly simple system, and I'm hoping to invite you in so you can experience how simple it will be, so that someday when we get to the point of potentially applying it to motorists, you'll know personally.
Mr. Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Woody, I know you're tasked with this stuff and to go forward with a lot of it. I sit here and look at a lot of this and I wonder, why are we wasting time and money doing some of this? Because you're talking 1.5 cents at 20 miles a gallon, you're 30 cents a gallon. So if I have a car that makes 20 miles a gallon or over, I'm not going to do the program. If my cars are below 20 miles a gallon at 15, which I have a Suburban and a one-ton truck, it might be beneficial for me to do it. And everybody's going to figure this out on getting in the program or out of the program. And I just don't see why we don't keep this simple and look at just a flat fee. You have an electric car, you pay $30 a month or whatever it is, or $300 a year, or $200 a year. But it seems to me we're wasting a lot of taxpayer dollars sitting here playing with all these different things. And it's been going on since I came into this building 4 years ago. And I'm not seeing really any results. And you see people kind of steering away from some of the electrical cars. The latest thing I saw was 90% of the people that bought Priuses wouldn't buy them again. So I'm just wondering if there'd be, why we can't just go the simple way of saying, hey, you buy an electric car, you're going to pay $300 a year and be done with this and stop wasting taxpayer dollars playing with all these different games and setting up people to collect tax dollars that we already have gas stations that do that. And then it could just be sent straight to ODOT rather than hire a bunch more employees to do something that's not going to make any money and just cost us money. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, two responses. One is I think it will be up to the Road User Fee Task Force to recommend which set of vehicles would be applied to, and then the legislature to decide which set of vehicles this will be applied to. I could see that it would be potentially unlikely for this system to be applied, especially in the early years, to vehicles that get less than the average fuel efficiency. It raises a lot of questions about what the rate ought to be and all of that, and you already know that. So I suspect what everybody will be talking about is fuel-efficient vehicles to try to bring them up to what more of an average level of contribution of road taxes. The second one is that, as I mentioned at the outset, user pays is a long-standing state policy, and if we go to a flat charge, we move off of user pay. So it's a significant policy change to do that. And that's, again, it's not for me to second guess. It's for me to try to comply with, to help with finding a way for user pays to work in the scenario where vehicles won't pay much fuel tax or maybe none.
Hold up. I guess that's what I'm getting at, Jim, is I'm sitting here looking at this coming in. I drive vehicles that are getting 18 miles a gallon. I'm spending $1,200 a month on fuel for my Suburban and my truck. So I'm paying $2,000 a year probably in taxes. You take a light vehicle that doesn't do as much damage to the road, they're paying $200 a year. And that's appropriate for the size and weight of their vehicle. We have a user fee tax in place now with the mileage tax. So the more you drive, the more fuel you use. And if you're driving a Prius, it's a much lighter vehicle that doesn't do as much damage to the road. So I'm just trying to figure out why we're spending all this money going down all these rabbit trails chasing these things when
it's pretty simple mathematical equation that we could come up with to fix this if we truly want to go after the electric cars or hybrids, where they would just pay a little extra on the registration fee or whatever, however we want to attack it. But then we don't have to create another basically company to collect tax revenue for the state of Oregon, and the state doing it as well, and it's just a lot more people that we're hiring. And I don't understand why this task force, why we keep going forward with it, or why this task force can't see this and come up with a simple solution and keep coming back with all these complex ideas. So I'm not part of the task force, or I don't see it, but to me, this is one of the biggest wastes of money that I've seen with taxpayer dollars in this committee that we should be addressing or could address very easily. And I'm just wondering if that committee's even discussed any of this, or if they're still chasing all these little gizmos for going out and getting people and getting money from them. So,
Co-Chair Reed. Co-Vice Chair Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One technical question and then a more policy question. You mentioned that the participants in the pilot would need vehicles that are 2004 or newer. Over the long run, what's the plan for vehicles that are that don't meet that qualification?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, I think that considering the types of vehicles, the application of a distance charge will be on, likely on new vehicles that have this capability. It's possible to go backwards and provide a non-technology option for others. And if policymakers want to consider that, that will have to be part of the understanding when making that decision. But our problem started a few years ago, but it'll become more intense as things go by. So it's important to get something in place for the newer vehicles now and get going with it, rather than worry about catching up with older vehicles, I think.
One additional question, Mr. Chair. Thanks. You mentioned that there were several numbers. I couldn't quite catch whether it was 28 or 18 that you're in the process of negotiating with. I hope some of them might be in Oregon, and that leads me to ask you what your view is on the long-term economic development potential of a program like this that might be of interest to other entities around the world. Do you think that as we figure this out, that technology, that expertise, the providers might end up exporting their services and products to other parts of the world?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, Oregon is the leader on this, and there are a number of other states that are involved, but we clearly are developing expertise that will be helpful to the rest of the nation and the world. There's no question about that. I can't say at this point how it will roll out, but I actually have another slide that talks about what's happening in the nation, if you'd like to see it, Mr. Chair.
We're perilously close on our time,
but on our materials.
Yeah. And we have it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Further questions? Yes, Director Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when it comes to out-of-state drivers, I assume that this would only apply to Oregon residents or registering a vehicle here. What sort of revenue are we going to lose by having, compared to the gas tax, by doing something like that with an out-of-state driver?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sheehan, the current direction of the task force is to address the out-of-state driver later.
Okay.
It has to do with, you know, how difficult it is to pass legislation anyway, and kind of minimize the number of issues you deal with, isolate them, solve them, and then you get a bill passed. So they recognize that we have to address out-of-state driver at some point, but they just haven't decided to go down that step at the moment.
Quick follow-up,
please.
And as it pertains to freight and trucking, would this create a problem of having Oregon trucking companies moving across the river to Washington in terms of trying to escape the gas tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sheehan, no, not at all. All trucking firms that drive through Oregon pay the weigh distance tax now, which is a distance-based charge based on axle weight. And that's a whole separate program. It's already underway, and and it's already had whatever effect it was going to have as far as out-of-state and in-state years ago. In fact, probably 70 years ago. So this is a wholly different. This is just for light vehicles.
Great, thank you.
Further questions? I just have one. It seemed to be that Representative Widener's remarks reflect a lot of the thinking that I've heard as I've gone across my district. And I'm curious how difficult it would be to reflect on one's receipt when one buys fuel, the amount paid for gas tax now. And then, in addition to that, show on that printout how much over or under they are when it comes to our estimate of the actual use of the road. Lots of assumptions would have to be made. But the problem we have is one of people not being aware of what they're paying currently and not also being aware of how much damage they're actually doing to the road. And until we educate everybody, this whole process, like pushing a rope. So I know the committee, since I've sat on it, is discussing these issues, but it's become more and more apparent that it's an issue of education. And I know you know this, but I would be curious the next time around, not today, to hear about those educational efforts. And I understand getting high-profile folk to engage in the pilot program would be educational. I think I probably would consider volunteering because I drive huge amounts of distance. And it would be very interesting to see how that might turn out. And I could use it for part of that educational process, which we must engage in because this is a problem that must be addressed. Further questions for Jim? Seeing none, thank you very much. And with that, colleagues, we're going to go off-road and to go to the industrial land availability. And we'll hear from, who do we want, Patrick? Do we want all three?
I think the whole panel.
The whole panel. Three, yeah. Keith, Bernie, and Kurt. Oh.
The railroad has one of their top three railroad recommendations. That's what we're here for.
I knew it.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Keith Levitt. I'm General Manager of Business Development and Properties at the Port of Portland. The Port is a partner on the Regional Industrial Lands study that we will report out to you today, along with Metro, NAIOP, which is the Commercial Real Estate Industry Association, and Kirk Olson is here with us representing NAIOP, Portland Business Alliance, and Bernie Bottomley is here as well. Bernie and I will take the slides. We will be quick through the summary because I think this raises a lot of interesting issues to discuss. So we'll try to go through the slides pretty quick. We have phase one and phase two of this industrial land study. And what we did was we really focused on not so much over a 20-year planning horizon, how much industrial land we have in the region, but really a snapshot of today. And asking ourselves how much readily available market-ready land do we have in the Portland metropolitan region. So the background of this study is really the focus in the region and throughout the state on job creation, income growth, and in particular the focus on traded sector economic development, creating more opportunities to grow our traded sector base. We've known for quite some time that we have a limited supply of industrial land. I know from just purely from the Port of Portland standpoint, we've typically been one of the largest owners of industrial land in the region, and we're very low on our supply of industrial land, and that's why we've been interested in this issue as well as interested in acquiring land over the last few years. The purpose of the project is really to create a tool, and it's a tool that we want to keep updated. Again, that's a tool that's focused more on the readiness of these larger strategic sites, and we use 25 acres as kind of that dividing line of focusing on the larger sites. So we want to keep this tool updated. We want to be able to inform the public policy dialogue going on in the region and ultimately engage in a discussion around how to move sites from Tier 3, which you'll see in a moment the definition of that, but that's really land that is not market ready, and how to move that land into more of a market ready status. The phase one process, we started with a pretty broad net. We've been at this study for a year, and I should also say that Group McKinsey is our consultant. We looked at 25 acres, the initial filter. We had multiple hundreds of sites that we looked at initially. They had to be 25 acres zoned industrial and within the urban growth boundary. We then took a look at site constraints, and we had a net developable acreage amount, and those sites still needed to be 25 acres or more net developable, not gross. And so that was a pretty major filter that we did at that next stage when we looked at the site analysis. I should also say we subtracted out user-owned sites. Intel is an example of a company that has a lot of expansion property, but it's not on the market today, so we put that in essentially a separate bucket since it's not on the market. We also looked at market readiness, transportation, how long does it take to get that site to a point where you can turn dirt and actually have jobs created. And out of that came a tiering structure, and we'll talk about the tiers here in the next slide. The first tier is consistent with Business Oregon's approach to the site certification program. If you can turn dirt on that site within 6 months, you're in Tier 1, and we would define that as it's market ready. If it takes 7 months, Tier 2 we defined as 7 months to 2.5 years. That essentially is not land that what you would find in your typical recruitment processes where companies are looking either around the state or around the country or even globally for land. They're going to want to be in that Tier 1 status, otherwise you're probably not going to be viable for recruitment. And it would take a lot more patience in Tier 2 and an investor that is that has patient capital to bring that Tier 2 site down to the Tier 1 and be market available. Tier 3 is even beyond that. We have a lot of land in Tier 3, and that's probably the big punchline of this study. We define that as 2.5 years and out. The Ports West Haden Island property is a good example of Tier 3 site. West Haden Island has a lot of issues, but in particular, the entitlement issues are not resolved yet with the City of Portland, and that would put that site out in that Tier 3 status. Just on to the findings here. There were 56 sites that made it into our inventory. Of those 56 sites, and again, these are 25-acre sites or above net developable, we had 9 Tier 1 sites, and we had 16 Tier 2 and 31 Tier 3. And a more healthy look at that would probably be where you've got Tier 1, 2, and 3 more equal as far as number of sites. When you dig a little deeper into the Tier 1 sites, we identified 5 of those Tier 1 having broad market appeal. Two of the sites the Port owns, and they're lease only, and in our experience is that there's a more discrete segment of the industrial marketplace that will lease property. They typically are going to want to own the real estate in order to fully appreciate the value of the land and secure the financing that they need. One of the sites was priced above the market. So again, five sites in the region with broad market appeal. And this is really the punchline. This is the distribution of sites looking at acreage. Most of the market activity is in that 25 to 50 acre category. And you can see that we've got 7 Tier 1 sites, but 21 Tier 3 sites. And then perhaps probably more challenging for us in the metro region is that we only have 1 currently Tier 1 50-acre site and only 1 100-acre site.
Excuse me. Yes, Representative Widener.
Yeah, that, when I was looking at the map, is that 100-acre site looks like by a chute road?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, it's the 1 100-acre site is the LSI site in Gresham. I believe you're probably looking ahead at the phase two.
Well, you're looking there. That one. And I was trying to see size-wise what was there, and that was the only one. And I know there's one field right there at the corner of Chute Road, and but according to this map, you can't really tell.
I believe that's a Tier 3 site because there's a lot of land assembly around it. The one Tier 1 50-acre site is the Nike Foundation site in that area in Hillsborough, just right off Highway 26. And Bernie will talk more about the site constraints, but this is really the fundamental challenge that we have. A lot of these sites have a lot of issues. You know, the premise of this whole discussion was to look inside the urban growth boundary and ask ourselves how ready is the land that we have zoned industrial within the urban growth boundary. A lot of these sites have brownfield issues. Several of these sites are in the lower Willamette Harbor, which is a Superfund area. We are wet, so we have a lot of wetland issues, so the permitting timeframes to be able to deal with the natural resource issues are significant, and you can see on down the list. So several sites are facing several of those constraints. Quickly, we'll talk about demand. This was a supply side study. We actually did not focus on demand. It raises a lot of issues about demand for these larger sites. What we know with the existing data is that there is consistent market interest in these larger, more strategic sites, if you will, that are in the 50 to 100 acre range. Business Oregon over the last year, in looking at the leads that come into the state, roughly 76 of those leads had site requirements on them, and 25% of those needed acreage above the 25 acre range. A survey was done by Johnson and Reed, interviewing six brokers throughout the metro area, looking over the last 10 years within the metro region, and they said 11 leads per year were needing sites that are greater than 50 acres. And I'll just say again, from the Port of Portland's standpoint, we've done over the last about roughly 8 years, we've done about seven deals, marine and industrial deals, above 25 acres. So we know just in our experience that there is consistent market interest for those larger sites. What do the traded sector industries need? I think if you look at the state of Oregon's economic development strategies and the industry clusters, and you look at the Portland metro region through Greater Portland Inc., it focuses on cluster development, and it's typically around traded sector industries. And this slide just gives you a good sense of the acreage requirements for those industry clusters. So clean tech, 50 acres, globally scaled like a Solar World, 100 acres. You see the manufacturing there. It can go a little further down in acreage. The high-tech campus, 25 acres, and then warehousing and distribution ranging between 25 and 80 acres. FedEx Ground is in this picture here. They actually bought a site that the port owned at the Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park, and it's a good example of the port buying the site and committing to the phase one development in a way that led to FedEx being able to have enough certainty to make that decision. And that's a 78-acre site. It's a former Superfund area. If they were needing to look for the 78 acres today, they probably wouldn't be able to locate in the region. They would likely have to be up I-5 into the Seattle area because of just lack of availability, and that's 850 jobs that have been created on that site.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bernie Bottomley, Vice President of the Portland Business Alliance. Keith talked about this process of figuring out how ready or not ready these various sites are. I'm going to talk about the properties that are in the phase or tier two and tier three, the ones that are not ready, and what it would take to get them to a point of readiness. So to do that, we selected 11 sites in tier two and tier three that were representative of the kinds of challenges that we had identified in the phase one of the process. So wetlands, site aggregation, transportation challenges, and so forth. So we selected those 11 sites. to study. We worked with the local jurisdictions to identify what kind of development would be appropriate for that parcel. And then we went through the site planning process to actually put a model development on that site, used independent market analytics to figure out what the employment levels and investment levels would be on that property, and then we calculated the cost of all of the site preparation and compared the two. This is just a map of the 11 sites, so very broadly distributed around the region, with, as I said, a variety of different challenges that they faced and a variety of different types of development on them, from heavy industrial, marine, high-tech, clean tech, and general manufacturing. So in terms of the cost of moving the sites from tier 2 and 3 to a tier 1 status, these are the major cost components that we identified, and as you can see, issues like floodplain mitigation, transportation, site surcharge, which is cut and fill, sanitary sewer, stormwater, etc., are all significant components of the site readiness costs, and they vary depending on site. This is just the average for all 11 sites that we looked at. Now, we also, as I said, placed model development on the site, and this is one model development on the sort of the most valuable site in terms of the type of investment that it would likely see. This is out in Hillsboro near Intel, and the type of development that we modeled for this site is similar high-tech manufacturing site. What's interesting about this is that it shows you what the tax consequences are of being successful in recruiting a significant new high-tech industry to the region. This assumes some kind of average tax benefits in terms of recruiting the candidate business, which is why you see the property tax kicking in there in year 9. The first column, or the lightly shaded area, is the development period, so there's some tax benefit in terms of the employment of workers and so forth, but after the facility is built and they begin to staff up and the individuals there begin to start paying payroll tax to the state and the facility itself starts paying property tax, you can see the revenue generated by a plant facility of this type. I think the key takeaway from this is really that over time, it's the payroll tax generation off of a site like this that is the significant tax benefit, while the local jurisdiction receives some benefit in the way of property tax. By far and away, the state is the big winner in terms of the revenue that's generated from that site. So the conclusions of the study, this phase two, are that there's very few large, truly large sites in any of the tiers, particularly in tier one and tier two. There's significant costs in bringing those sites to readiness that are in tier two and tier three. The large sites, as Keith mentioned, tend to be very complex. They require site aggregation, which means you have, you know, 2 to 15 or so owners. Not all the owners are on the same page in terms of whether they want to sell, what they want to sell for, what they see the market as. So it takes a long time to aggregate those sites together. I'm sure you know the story of the Intel site in Hillsboro. It happened to be a failed housing development. The city had an urban renewal district that overlaid that location. It took them many, many years to aggregate that site together, but it paid huge dividends because that's where Intel is located today. So the rest of our conclusions are that private sector developers, some of the sites that are in Tier 2 and Tier 3 have challenges that the private sector can address. They have risk levels and time frames that the private sector can respond to. But other sites don't have that kind of characteristic. They're really going to take some kind of patient, risk-taking investor. In many cases, that's going to require some sort of public entity to come forward. And as Keith mentioned, the example of the port is one that we've used in the region where the port can purchase the property, take on the risk that, you know, it will be some time before the property can turn and secure a paying tenant. Our next steps are to finalize our Tier 2, our Phase 2 findings. We'll meet with all of the local jurisdictions that participated in the study, so all the cities of Hillsborough, Gresham, Portland, Clackamas County, and others participated in looking at the individual parcels that are in their jurisdiction. We'll vet our findings with them. We're developing a working group with Business Oregon to look at, or with the Oregon Business Plan, I should say, to look at what kinds of policy implications the results of the study imply. And then we'll start rolling those out in the fall. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions for this panel?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a whole bunch, but I'll try to narrow it down here. I guess the primary question would be, how do we compare to surrounding states such as Washington, Idaho, in Tier 1, Tier 2 sites?
It's an excellent question. We get, whenever we make this presentation, we get that question. The scope of the study didn't really look at that in detail. We took a very sort of analytical approach to this, really drilled down on a site-by-site basis to look at whether the site was truly ready for development or not. A pretty unvarnished approach, and very few jurisdictions have done it that way. Typically what they are doing is sort of a marketing piece which says, we've got millions of acres, it's all ready to go, and you know, come and see what we've got. So it's been difficult to get a clear handle on that. I would say, generally speaking, we're on the low end of the types of available land. Some jurisdictions have huge swaths. Phoenix, for example, you know, has gigantic inventory. Some jurisdictions have even less than we do, say Seattle, downtown Seattle, the city of Seattle itself, just because of the geography around it. But generally speaking, looking at the inventories that are out there, we're on the low end.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Yes.
So, in my opinion, this is not good that we're on the low end. And therefore, the next question I have is, and if I'm a business owner, if I'm in their shoes, I'd be, okay, we've got one choice in Oregon. Let's see what Idaho is if we're looking for that area, or Arizona. What are they doing differently? What is different?
Yes, Chair Benz, Representative Lindsay, different things in different areas. Some of them have more robust infrastructure development programs, so they have more money for roads in a lot of cases. Some have, you know, they don't have urban growth boundaries, for example, so the theoretical acreage that's out there is larger because they don't have those kinds of restrictions. The practical availability of that land may be no better than here because, you know, once you've identified the land, you still have to build the infrastructure out to it.
Thank you. Let me just change the question. If there's one thing that we could emulate, what would that be, in your opinion?
Well, I think the one thing we have to look at is where the benefit of the development accrues in terms of tax revenue. And in this case, the state is clearly a huge winner in whenever one of these developments goes forward. So I think we need to look at how can the state participate in the process of helping us move the parcels from Tier 3 and Tier 2 into Tier 1, whether that's helping with the infrastructure or helping to shorten the timeline that the development faces in getting through the permitting and other processes.
not a follow-up, but just a general statement. That makes sense to me because primarily the local county, local cities that are preparing and doing the legwork on this, and if they're not going to have the majority of the benefits from it, and someone else is, what incentive do they have to go out and do that legwork? So it's something we ought to, I would like to see us drill down a little bit more on.
I agree. Co-chair Hunt.
Thanks. I mean, I think one of the incentives that should be a motivator is the job benefits, but you're right, it may not be as direct. I'm interested in, I think Bernie talked about the timeline in terms of the policy recommendations coming in the fall to spring, which doesn't necessarily mesh well in terms of the next legislative session. Especially looking at these constraint issues, the majority of which have direct, at least state policy implications, financial or regulatory. Do you see any way, I don't know if I want to ask you to short circuit your process, but do you see any way as you're working through at least this fall, that there may be one or two things that become so obvious that I guess you can short circuit the piece, sure, of your process and say 2013 legislative session, this is the one thing or these are the two things that really get at some of these development constraints that we would recommend you focus on in 2013?
Sure. I think speaking for the group, we'd be happy to do that. And part of that timeline is driven by the Oregon Business Plan timeline, and I don't think that timeline has quite caught up with the annual session timeline yet, so we're working on that.
Questions? Yes, Representative Sim.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, the dumb kids formula of the overall economic value of industrial lands would seem to be sort of the number and scope of available and filled industrial land sites multiplied by the value generated by those each of those sites on average. I have a question on each. One, the overall number in the study, I assume that includes potential brownfield redevelopment sites, but I want to make sure that my assumption is accurate.
It does, although I have to say one caveat is that we picked representative sites of the issues, the challenges that the Tier 2 and Tier 3 sites face. They're not the easiest sites to develop. So if you were a developer, you would pick a different set of sites, sure, to work on first. We did include brownfields in that mix. The Time Oil site down in the Portland Harbor, mm-hmm, was probably the poster child for that effort, and mm-hmm, although it doesn't show up in the graph, for that site, brownfields issues are much, much higher cost.
Mm-hmm. Follow up. And second, what can we do, what might we do to maximize the value of the use of the sites, right? So, Intel, probably greater or lesser value than Solar World, greater or lesser value than Genentech, probably greater value than FedEx Ground, right, in terms of jobs, in terms of wages, in terms of spin-off effects and other sort of economic catalytic activity. What are things we should be thinking about or things that we can do either at your end, this committee's end, legislature, state, city, whatever, to maximize the value of the use of the sites?
And I'd like to ask Keith to, or Kirk to respond to that a little bit. I think the thing that we have to be careful of is not adding constraints to the sites where we want to dictate sort of the highest and best use of that, mm-hmm, as opposed to the market dictating that, mm-hmm, because we don't always read those signals correctly. And even though a site like FedEx might not have the same level of employment and wages as the Intel site is, they're both necessary to the, health of the regional economy. You have to have warehouses to support, high-tech and advanced manufacturing. So you can't really pick one and say we're just going to do that one because it's got the highest return on it.
Yeah, and if I may, Chairs Benson and Hunt and Representative Smith, my name is Kirk Olson. I'm a partner with Dermody Properties. We're a national industrial development firm, and I am NAOP's representative for this study. NAOP is an association of commercial real estate developers based in D.C. And yeah, to Bernie's point, just to echo it, developers want flexibility. If they're going to invest capital and take on risk, over the number of years, say it takes to get a Tier 2 into a Tier 1 status, that developer will want flexibility. And so limiting, imposing further constraints on any site that a developer is interested in, I think would increase the risk, frankly, and lessen the viability of that potential development occurring in the time frame that is projected.
Well, it was a pretty unsatisfactory answer. I'm going to take another crack. Yes. So what I heard was, don't make it harder for us to do certain things because we want to make sure something happens. Okay, I totally don't disagree with that. Okay, which is another way of saying I, relatively speaking, agree with that. And I still have the question of what can be done to maximize that. Because I understand from, you know, the real estate developer, we'll get the deal done and get out, right? From an economic development standpoint, we want to maximize the value of the limited sites that we have. That obviously doesn't mean a rule, please no FedEx Ground, go away, right? It means, you know, what things can be done, what might we think about to maximize the value of the use of the limited number of sites we've got.
I'll take a crack at that. I think one of the biggest issues that we found in this study, it's not a new one, but the transportation infrastructure issues related to these large strategic sites is one area that you could absolutely work on, get a good return on that investment, because in the FedEx Ground example is a good one. They need a lot of land. They needed 78 acres. It's 850 jobs. And that plant is about to expand even further, and they're talking to us about more, you know, more land. It's all good. The community likes it. We compete very well for those trade-related distribution and logistics uses. We have very good rail. We've typically, over the years, had good land available. We're running to the end of that now. But trade-related activity, which includes warehousing and distribution and includes advanced manufacturing, all of that needs to be looked at together. And I'd say the transportation access to these sites is probably the most critical piece of it.
I would just add one other piece of that, which is the transportation planning rule. We're kind of inside the urban growth boundary. What we're trying to do is densify. And what we're running into with the transportation planning rule in a way is sort of limits to densification, because we can't build additional infrastructure where you already have a built-out system, and yet we still face that issue if we put more vehicles, more trucks in that area, we run up against the transportation planning rule. So some mechanism, some flexibility in that would be a helpful tool.
Was that he just told you to say that? Was that what that was? That,
actually,
was
I
that
just
the whisper? Was that whisper? Well done. You didn't even have to introduce yourself for the record or anything. It was well done.
Yes, Co-Chair.
I'd be interested in, Keith, especially based on you almost completely drew the connection between talking about infrastructure and you're talking about the FedEx plant. Maybe for members of the committee or the audience who have not made the connection, talk about the state-funded infrastructure investments and how that was or was not critical in terms of landing that facility and those jobs.
Yeah, so I think FedEx Ground is a good example. The Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park is a good example. It's a site, it's 750 acres. It was a Superfund site. It's inside the urban growth boundary. It's zoned industrial. The port purchased the site with the potential that FedEx Ground may move out there, but we did it really on spec as FedEx being the ultimate anchor tenant. We were able to put together a phase one development package that really was what brought them to the site. It gave them the certainty to be able to do their portion of the investment. And there was a couple of state tools that we used that were very important. One was really through the Special Public Works Program to be able to get a loan to finance the road development that we needed. But there was also an investment made by the legislature in the last major round of transportation investment to deal with some of the interchange-related issues that has been key. We still are, I would say that's a good example of a large site, very complicated, doesn't pencil well because of all the complexity, and still needs one more shot of transportation investment. We've been looking in trying to get the Tiger Grant federal process lined up for that as well, but it's still kind of one major transportation project away from that phase two of that development becoming viable.
A
couple of questions. First of all, very much appreciate you guys' presentation today. It's hugely important for our state, unbelievably important. I've had the opportunity to work with Michael Dermody on a number of his projects, and I'm very happy to have you here today. It strikes me that Oregon is in a perpetual state of planning gridlock. What we do is we create these rules, and then we spend days and weeks and years trying to figure out a way to get around them, which we just heard from right there. And so the question I have has to do with maybe focusing on the one slide on page 5, which says demand for large sites. And I just want to emphasize, it says consistent interest in 50 and 100-acre parcels based on public-private data, even during the current economic downturn. Consistent interest. And somehow we've locked ourselves in to a small area, and people rush around inside that area afraid to look out. And it's in my part of the world, of course, where we have nothing but space, about 10,000 square miles of it adjacent to the land use planning wasteland of Idaho, we probably have some opportunity to expand if we can get around these, I hate to call them Portland imposed rules, but that's indeed the case. So I'm sitting here with you in front of us, and we're focusing on Portland. My question to the three of you is, how much, I see it here, but how much of our problems are self-imposed? And I understand the need for planning, not perpetual planning, but the need for a certain amount of it. But the question is, how much of this is politically imposed? Is it all politically imposed? Or is it, because you talked about infrastructure and the need to fund it, I get it. But I also see a lot of stuff that's not dollars. So I'd like some sort of a rough guess at how much is self-imposed and how much is dollar-imposed.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess what I would say is we definitely wanted to get a reality check within the urban growth boundary and kind of forgetting the debate about expanding the urban growth boundary, which is always a very live issue within our and kind of sport within certainly within the metro region and throughout the state for that matter, and really get a reality check of what does it take to get these sites market ready within the urban growth boundary. And yes, I think we are facing a point in time now where kind of the historic inventory, the low-hanging fruit has been plucked, so to speak. The port has owned a lot of that low-hanging fruit. We've, you know, Riviera Industrial District, Swan Island, Portland International Center. These are major industrial parks in the city and within the region. They're just about done as far as being fully developed, and they were developed over about a 40-50 year time period. What we do see is that because of our geography and because of our climate, we do have a lot of issues that drive up cost on developing land beyond just the constraint of our land use planning process.
I might add that it is self-imposed. You know, when our land use policy actions create the urban growth boundary, that is to constrain the supply of land. It does not consider demand except for demand projections accommodating for the next 20 years, for example. But generally speaking, it is to constrain the supply of land, our intents and our acts. So, you know, when we look at the supply of industrial land inside the UGB, you know, it looks like a very large number in aggregate. But really what this study reveals is the story behind that aggregate number can be quite telling and really needs to be told, and that is every piece of land, every parcel, no matter what its size, has its own story. And that story can be that it can be very challenging to develop any particular parcel in this intentionally constrained environment.
And of course that would be the case because that's all that's going to be left as we've gone through everything else. You're going to get to more and more and more expensive opportunities, if that's the right word for it, all because we're captured inside the UGB. And it strikes me, again, it's so important that we all state, that Oregon chooses to be poor. That's what we're doing. We put a circle around these places, and we say we're going to stay within it, and people go elsewhere to do their business. And this study shows it to one extent or another. We've got like 1 minute left. Is there any other questions, Representative
White? Mr. Chair, if I may, just to kind of add with what you're saying is, look at Redmond when they were wanting to develop. Prime example of UGB and transportation issues at one place that stopped development from happening. I mean, and for you're right on the mark when you say Oregon's choosing to be poor. We are creating a state of dependence and dependency, and we need to change it, and we need to put people back to work. So this is one of the biggest issues we're facing right here.
Thank you for the thoughts. Seeing none, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Say hello to Michael for me.
Will do.
And with that, we will make a U-turn and go to the Dr. and Steve Statham.
Something to do with the end of the meeting. We always have the end of the road analogy. So,
thank you very much for your patience and waiting. Please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chairs, Ms. Co-Vice Chairs, the remainder of the committee. I'm Dr. Brian Drucker. I'm the director of the OHSU United Cancer Institute. I'm very pleased to be here to testify about what we're attempting to accomplish at the OHSU United Cancer Institute. By way of background, let me just give you a little bit of background about myself and the circumstance of my moving to Oregon about 19 years ago in July. At the time, I was at Harvard's Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and I had a dream of targeting cancer specifically without harming normal cells. At the time, the view was that was impossible and that would never happen. And I was offered the opportunity not to stay on at Harvard. I believed in my dream and began to look for a place that shared that similar view. And I found my way to OHSU, and Dr. Grover Bagby established the OHSU Cancer Center. Grover believed in that view and thought that this did have a future. He offered me a position here, a laboratory space, and within 6 weeks of my moving here, I began to work on compounds for a specific type of leukemia that killed leukemia cells without harming normal cells. Then began about a five-year battle with a large drug company that held the patent to that drug and still holds the patent to convince them to go to clinical trials in a very small indication. Because I was both a physician and a scientist, I had patients who needed this life-saving medication. I was ultimately able to convince the drug company to move into these trials. And in June of 1998, we started clinical trials here. First patients in the world received this medication known as Gleevec. Within 3 years, we received FDA approval for this medication, which is the fastest approval for a drug on FDA record. For this particular leukemia called chronic myeloid leukemia, we took a disease which had a 3 to 5 year life expectancy and now has a 95% 5 year life expectancy with a single once a day pill that kills cancer cells without harming normal cells. When you hear words like personalized medicine, targeted therapy, that started right here in Oregon, and I'm very proud of the fact that it happened here in our own backyard. Now, in the last 4 or 5 years, I looked at what am I going to do next, and I've looked at many, many opportunities around the country and have turned down many offers to move to other states. I've decided that I wanted to do something here in Oregon to give back to my state that I've come to love living and working in. And as I've looked at what we can do, we clearly have a leadership role in this world of personalized cancer therapy. And when I moved to transition my job role to become the director of the OHSU Cancer Institute, I thought that we can make a unique impact by delivering on the promise of personalized cancer therapy. By targeting cancer with knowledge of understanding what drives the growth of each and every cancer, matching the right patient with the right drug that will give them the best outcome, and then moving that out beyond the borders of OHSU into our entire state and our region. So as we put together that plan, we have received broad-based support. We currently receive over $100 million in National Institutes of Health dollars. We're the only National Cancer Institute designated cancer center in the state of Oregon and the only one between Seattle and Sacramento. We have that designation because of the strong research support that we receive. We've also received substantial support from our community. We received a $100 million unrestricted gift from Phil and Penny Knight in 2009 that will be given as about $14.5 million per year over 7 years. We received $5 million in support from John Gray. We received $2.5 million from the Gelled One Corporation, another $800,000 per year from Safeway Corporation. So we have a significant broad base of support. As we look at what we will do with that fund, we put together a strategic plan. Because we want to spend this money purposefully. We need to make sure that we bring the best and the brightest researchers here to Oregon who understand the view that research has a purpose and has a mission, and that our mission is to take our basic findings from the laboratory and translate them to good for people that are suffering from cancer. We've already begun on an ambitious recruitment agenda. We brought Joe Gray from from Lawrence Berkeley in California with his team of 20 scientists. He's actually a physicist by background and is looking at putting all the pieces of cancer together and understanding them in real time. What I do is I'm like a mechanic that takes all the pieces apart. Joe puts them all together and understands where all the pieces fit together and how that works in a living, breathing person. We've also brought in Lisa Cousins from UC San Francisco with her team of another 20 researchers. She's one of the foremost breast cancer researchers in the country. So between Joe Gray and Lisa Cousins, we have one of the best breast cancer research teams in the entire nation. And what I've liked particularly about Joe and Lisa is that they understand this mission, that our role is to take and translate our findings from the lab into clinical reality. And Joe Gray actually over the weekend emailed me a plan where he can take 20 FDA-approved drugs, take a laboratory sample from a woman with breast cancer, and match them to what therapy will work. And that actually translates into significant intellectual property. It translates into significant, significantly better treatments for women suffering from breast cancer. That's the kind of thing that we're trying to do. In addition, we brought in a gentleman by the name of Dr. Paul Spellman, who is one of the leading what's known as genomic researchers. What the genome research is taking in sequence the entire genome of thousands of human cancers. When Gleevec was FDA approved in 2001, we had sequenced one human genome at a cost of about $100 million. Today, we can sequence an entire genome for about $5,000. In a few years, that's going to be $1,000. We now will have the capability of sequencing close to 25,000 cancers with 25,000 matched normals. And Paul Spellman is one of the leaders of that type of research, understanding all the abnormalities in cancer and being able to decipher all the knowledge we need to bring better treatment for cancer patients. The other thing that we're investing is what we call the Knight Diagnostics Lab. In order to match people with treatments, we need to take a sample of tumor and analyze it for all the abnormalities that drive the growth. In our laboratory, we can analyze over 650 different mutations across 50 genes. And we're actually the leading center in the entire nation at the ability to do that. What that allows us to do is take a sample of tumor and identify what clinical trials might be available and to bring those clinical trials here. We also can bring that capability across the entire state and actually have a national presence for this laboratory, so that can bring us some revenue that we can then turn back into our discovery engine. We also recognize that we need substantial collaborations. So if you look at the Oregon, the higher education building that's going down on the waterfront, that is a collaboration between OHSU, Oregon State, and PSU in our life sciences building. One of the key tenants there will actually be a collaboration between Joe Gray's laboratory and FEI, a Hillsborough corporation that has high-end electron microscope, so we can begin to look at cancer cells at different locations throughout the body. They've actually agreed to give us deep discounts on equipment while they create a living laboratory so they can get into the health sciences delivery as they look at the next generation of their equipment. We also established a collaboration with Oracle to help us begin to manage all this information that's going to come out of the genome. And we'll look to do other partnerships. But lastly, it's not all about OHSU. One of our missions is to make sure that the level of cancer care is elevated throughout the entire state and the entire region. For close to a decade, we have had a formal collaboration with the Salem Cancer Institute right here. We've also established recently a letter of intent with Legacy Health Systems to begin to deliver cancer care throughout the Portland metro region. We've had a long-standing agreement with Coos Bay. We also, over the last couple of years, have established a relationship with Astoria at Columbia Memorial Hospital to site an OHSU Knight Cancer Institute clinician at that site to deliver care 2 days a week in Astoria. So our aspirations are not only to understand cancer, match patients with therapy, but also to deliver this care throughout our state and throughout our region. So I'm extremely proud to call myself an Oregonian. I'm extremely proud about the impact that we've had on cancer, and I'm extremely optimistic about the impact that we're going to have over the next decade as we continue to fight cancer and the impact that will have by delivering that care here first in the nation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And you have some to add before we ask
questions? Very brief.
Please, go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Steve Statham. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Knight Cancer Institute. Thank you for having us testify. Dr. Drucker is a tough act to follow, so I'll be brief. I just want to underscore the point that although our mission is to end cancer as we know it, we think if we do that well, we will have a substantial economic development impact that will be positive for the region. And Dr. Drucker mentioned a few things. I'll just add a couple other points. We expect during this decade to invest between $200 and $300 million in the Cancer Institute through philanthropy and through plowing back revenues from these commercial ventures in terms of the molecular diagnostics and those sorts of activities. So there'll be a substantial investment that we'll be making, and the institution, OHSU, will be making in the growth of the Cancer Institute. We'll be attracting additional research awards from outside the region. Just since 2010, we've increased our awards over the baseline in 2010 by about $5 million. We've added 100 new employees at the Cancer Institute, which again is part of OHSU, but we track these numbers. Dr. Drucker mentioned the partnerships with some large companies, but we also have a lot of partnerships in the works with various companies, including the potential for spinoffs in Oregon. We have more ideas than we can handle, so we have hired someone that we're calling an associate director for business development, because we think that we're good at a lot of things, but we need to partner with other companies, particularly to get these technologies and ideas out into commercial application that may not be strictly clinical applications. So we are doing a lot in those areas, and we are looking forward to continued success in partnerships with industry to attract these new dollars to the state to grow our research further and to create technologies that can have commercial application. Thank you again for letting us testify.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes.
I'd just like to say we've talked a lot about House District 30 today. It looks like you know a lot about our district, Intel and FEI, and mentioned some of those things. And I just noticed as well, going back a little bit, 4 of the 9 Tier 1 sites are House District 30, and many of them support this good the good research that you're doing, and we need to make sure we're always applauding these people, these entities that create jobs, that create wealth, that create charity in House District 30.
Representative Nathanson.
That's a good question.
Thank you.
That was an easy one. Thank you.
Mine is probably more of a comment also, unless you have a response. I want to congratulate you on the amazing and excellent work that you're doing that matters to lives, but you've also pointed out how it matters to the economy. So along those lines, we were hearing from some people earlier this morning about freight and how to move freight around, which is also part of Oregon's economic picture. And it might seem odd to some people to call medical research part of an industrial cluster, for example. But if you think about industry sectors and think about medical research and the money that the state invests in research centers, when we think of ONAMI, and then when I think of the work of Oregon Biosciences Association, for example, there really is a lot going on. You're obviously in a leadership position here, but I was at an investment conference just a week or two ago, Willamette Angel Conference. They meet every year. One year it's in Corvallis, another year it's in Eugene. They go back and forth. And I attended one evening to talk with these businesses that were competing for angel investment funds. And the one that won the fund this year was Cascade Pro Drug, also involved in this kind of research and innovative drugs. So I'm real pleased with what's going on with Oregon. Does that mean that Oregon is going to start getting national or international attention that is different than we've had in past decades? Are people noticing yet?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult not to notice if you start to look at some of the things that we've done, and in particular some of the industrial relations that we've built, for example, FEI, Oracle, and other companies. People are going to begin to wonder, how did Oregon do that? What are they doing differently that Stanford or San Diego or Boston isn't doing to allow these companies to want to work with a place like OHSU? And we're working on a national piece as all these pieces come together to really bring more attention to what's happening here, which we think is actually quite unique. We really understand that we have to build these public-private partnerships to get as much done and as quickly as we can. And in response to your comment, which I greatly appreciate, Representative Nathanson, for me it's about putting patients first. If we put patients first and focus on, let's get better treatments to patients that need them now, and then put aside any politics that academics have and other things that we think about as barriers. How do we get rid of those barriers to get things done as quickly as we can? Then we open ourselves to these possibilities. Where other institutions think about what can we do to protect what we have. We want to protect our patients, and we put that first, and by doing that, we can achieve more.
Let's see if we'll work our way this way, Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are your biggest challenges in terms of recruiting and retaining talented researchers?
I'll start, and there are many challenges. First of all, to get somebody like Joe Gray here was huge, and having that first star person in took a lot of effort and arm twisting and resources. But once we got somebody like Joe Gray here, people started to take notice. And then when Lisa Cousins came, we now have momentum on our side, and people are beginning to look, at least in the research community, and we're getting phone calls from people. What's happening there? We want to move there. So we've gotten over that hurdle of Oregon's a little bit off of the beaten path into it's now part of the mainstream for cancer research. So we've overcome that hurdle. Now the hurdles we face really are resources and space, and we're running out of both of them at a faster rate than I would have thought when we started on this. I would have thought $100 million seems like a big number, but we're burning through that very quickly. And we're going to look for other sources of revenue and other philanthropy. But then we're also bumping up against space. We'll get a little bit of boost as we move into the life sciences building in a couple of years, but most of that's already spoken for. So as you know, we have a pretty ambitious space plan. We are going to run out of both space and resources, but that's part of the reason we need some commercial success with our diagnostics lab so we can see a return on that investment.
Yeah, I would just add a couple of practical things, Representative Sheehan. One is, researchers coming here often have spouses who need jobs, and the economy has not been very good, as we all know, and actually that can become a barrier. That's true around the country, but it is definitely a factor here. And some of the younger ones, although they're rising stars, they have children in school, and the school system, of course, is an issue. So we've noticed we're still able to recruit. I think it's harder now, but I think it's true generally. But our reputation is better, but I think just the climate generally has made it a little harder to recruit. And we've had some success, but not every single one has been landed. So those are a couple of challenges.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions?
Yeah.
We'll just keep working our way down. Representative Reed, Co-Vice Chair Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of the questions I was going to ask have already been asked, but I wonder, apart from additional support in terms of resources and space and so on, are there particular roles that that this committee or the legislature in particular can do to help extend your mission?
Do you want to start?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at that, Representative Reed. We worked briefly together on Oregon Inc. when I was going off and you were coming on. Certainly Otrati and the Signature Research Centers are partners, ONAMI, and can be partners in our effort. Some of Joe Gray's science involves really nanoscale imaging. So I think those efforts are very important to sustain. And Otrati in the compound screening for drug development, which can still happen in Oregon, I think, are important. The other area, and Dr. Druka can speak about it more eloquently, is really in prevention and outreach around the state. So getting cancer screenings around the state, education, there's a lot of prevention work that can be done. Rural areas are often the hardest hit per capita in terms of quality of health care, access to health care. And there's a great opportunity. One of our programs is around cancer prevention and control. So the outreach, screenings, education, and those sorts of things are, to me, very logical places where the state could be a partner with the Cancer Institute.
I think that Steve has said that quite well when you think about, and clearly there's been a consistent message from OHSU that and we create jobs and very high-paying, technically skilled job workforce, so that investment in our programs, actually you see an immediate return on that investment with the jobs we create. But then, as Steve also alluded to, if we have a healthier population in Oregon, more in the workforce, more able to maintain a healthy lifestyle, either free of cancer or if they develop cancer at a very early stage when it's highly curable, that's what we want to be. And if we're going to lower the death rate in the state of Oregon, we have to think about prevention and screening and early diagnosis. It's not all going to be about treating late where it's extremely expensive. And so that means women getting mammograms as recommended, colonoscopies as recommended, sunscreen, when the sun comes out in our great state, and the things that are really common that we know we need to do, we need to get that message out, but we need to make sure that those things happen, and that's also part of our outreach plan.
Thanks. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, first of all, I want to thank you, Doctor, for being here and all the work you're doing. It's this kind of stuff that is great to hear that it's going on in the state of Oregon, and the fact that you're looking at not any having barriers and getting things to the patients when they need them. The thing I'm concerned about is you're talking about expansion and everything and running out of room, and I know where OHSU is and there's not a lot of room to build over there, and you got the privilege of sitting here and listening to whatever everything else that's going on in the state. And it's something that concerns me a little bit because I didn't see any place where we had any developable land around OHSU that's ready to go. So I'm just wondering if that's a concern with the hospital or if those discussions have happened up there, because we've created all the barriers in our land use policies. So
I have some history on that. In our case, we do have the land available. We went through a lot of pain to get that arranged, but the Schnitzer campus and the South Waterfront are zoned and have the infrastructure for our expansion. Fortunately, the light rail is coming over there. We have a tram that connects to the upper campus. So we have the land space. What we don't have is the building space yet. These are tend to be expensive buildings, and but the first one is going in at the north end of the Schnitzer campus. So in this case, Representative, we do have the land capacity.
Mr. Smith, did you have a question?
Yeah, Tobias asked my question. I did want to make a comment, which is thank you, and not just thank you for testifying, but thank you for saving my father-in-law's life. He had a gastrointestinal stromal tumor and took Gleevec, and he was supposed to live for 6 months, and that was several years ago, and he's still kicking around.
Right.
So I want to say thank you for that. I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Well, thank you, Representative Smith. And I travel around quite a bit, and I love hearing the stories about people's lives have been saved. That's what it's always been about.
And usually they're not on a committee to which you're testifying.
They're usually, well, amazingly enough, there's usually somebody that has a connection. And the gastrointestinal stromal tumor is one that I'm particularly proud of, but not many people know about. But early on during the profiling of Gleevec, it was my lab that showed that it would work against a target in gastrointestinal stromal tumor. And we were able to convince Novartis to expand the clinical trials to one patient. And it worked in that one patient in Finland. And they rapidly expanded the clinical trials and then got that through the FDA very shortly after they did for leukemia. And so we're very proud of that achievement as well.
Well, I want to join the panel in thanking you for joining us today. And I did have a question, though, and it has to do with the relative return on investment of dollars we might invest in your area. Obviously, when it comes to healthcare, it has an additional unmeasurable advantage of what we just heard about. But the question would be, if we have a choice between investing in healthcare and something else, how do we show the return for additional jobs and additional investment from other places?
Stevie, I thought you'd done that analysis pretty recently, or am I putting you on the spot?
Well, no, I think OHSU has done an economic impact analysis that we can make available, and it shows the economic return from the state's investment in OHSU is very high because the state investment is down, I think, below $40 million now, and the economic impact of OHSU generally is about $4 billion. We import a lot of federal dollars to the state, but also in cancer, I would emphasize the direct return would be, in addition to jobs from growing the scientific enterprise, the savings in healthcare, because personalized medicine for cancer means getting the right drugs early on and avoiding wasteful treatments, chemotherapy treatments that don't work. And the cost of the state in terms of Medicaid dollars and other costs, health benefit dollars, is tremendous. And so the more we can succeed at that, the more the state will save eventually by getting the right care to cancer patients or prevention and screenings. And that'll save you on Medicaid dollars and as an employer, a major employer of people, it'll save you a lot of money.
Right. And in order to make these weighing and balancings that you guys know we engage in here, we've got to have that type of data. So if you could get that to us at some point, it will be used. Particularly, I'd be very interested, though, in knowing as we put additional money into your new buildings, how much more business that brings into the state. Hard to measure, but maybe the anecdotes will do the trick. But I just wanted, we're kind of out of time. Final questions here. I really appreciate you being here today. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And with that, members, if there's nothing further, we are adjourned.